All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF it's called. Welcome to it. Glad you're here. Thanks for coming. Got a good show today. I'm trying to do the stuff that people do at the beginning of shows. Oh, man, what have we got for you today? What a show. And then I'm supposed to tell you what's on the show. Today on the show, and then I'm going to say some names and set them up properly. From the movie Lady Bird and Roseanne, of course, we have Laurie Metcalf is with us today on the show here in the garage. Ugh, see, I can do that. But Laurie is here, and it was really an honor to speak to her because I think she's one of the greatest actresses we have at this juncture. Also, before Laurie, I'm going to do a little shorty with my pal Tom Segura. Tom Segura is here. He's got a new comedy special out called Disgraceful. Segura is a very funny guy. I always like seeing him, so he stopped by. How's everybody doing? You all right? How's it feel to be living in a country that's slowly becoming one of the bigger shitholes on the planet? And I'm saying that like we're using the word shithole now. But I have to be honest with you. I still believe in my heart that a much larger percentage of people just think that this president's a shitty person and a shitty president. That's the amazing thing about what's happening right now is there really is no way to deny that he is probably the worst president we've ever had. But also the fact that he's a shitty person. There's just no way to deny it. He's one of the great shitty people. Like right up there with the shittiest people ever. And this is not political. I am not being partisan. I'm not being liberal, Democrat, progressive. I'm not speaking from the left. This is just an observational reality. You can watch this guy for an hour and go like, holy shit, this guy is one of the shittiest people that's ever lived, let alone to lead a country or do anything. He's just a horrible, compassionless, spiteful, hateful, delusional person. This is not partisan politics. This is just an astute observation from another human being. Here's the political part. Worst fucking president we've ever had. Here's the non-political part. Shittiest person I think I've ever seen get attention in mainstream culture in the history of the planet. How's that? Is that overdoing it? Just a shitty person. We all know it. I'm tired of looking at his face. I'm tired of seeing pictures of his face and the weird thing he does with his mouth when he talks and all the pictures. It's this weird pucker hole. Ugh, no shortage of aggravation. But I'm trying to stay chipper. I did go to the Critics' Choice Awards last week, last Sunday. It was my first awards show. I wore my fancy suit. Me and Sarah the Painter got decked out in my new three-piece suit, my new shoes. Felt great. Felt great to be in the fancy suit. I only have that one suit, and it probably costs as much as three suits, three pretty good suits. But I have it, and I'm going to have it forever. But now I got the SAG Awards coming up, so what do? I wear the same suit, maybe with a different shirt or without the vest. Is that how it works? Or am I just going to keep upping it? Am I now in the world where I need to get a few more suits? I don't think so. I think, if anything, I'm on my way out of the world, in my mind and in my heart. I'm in northern New Mexico, cooking on a gas stove. That's where I am, making tea, looking at the birds, waiting for the snow to melt. So, the Critics' Choice Awards, my first award show as a nominee. It's actually only my second award show on that level at all. I went to the Independent Spirit Awards once, because I was a presenter, and it was in a hangar, an airport hangar at Santa Monica Airport, the Critics' Choice Awards. And like I said, we're all dressed up. I talked to people. I got pictures taken. It's always really kind of a weird thing to walk a line and, you know, have a bunch of photographers there. And when I walk up, they're just, you know, not that excited. But when an actress walks up, they're like, hey, 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 with me. I'm like, Mark Maron. They're like, Mark, over here. Mark, over here. I'm not complaining. It's just part of the gig. But again, as some of you know, I do enjoy, I don't know, I like looking at movie stars. That's why I like watching these shows. And I get to the show, we get seated. I'm at the table with Alison Brie, Betty Gilpin, some executives from Netflix, and then a couple of people I did not know. Food was not great. It was sitting there already when we got there. But a bunch of big tables, and it was a huge place. And it's one of those situations where there's so many people there that you can't see, you can't just, you know, notice all the celebrities. You just, all of a sudden, you're just kind of moving your eyes across the horizon of folks. Angelina Jolie was right in front of me, sitting with the head of Netflix, Ted. Next to, on the other side of Ted, was Adam Sandler. And he was, they were right at the next table for me. And in my mind, I always thought there was a little bit of tension between me and Adam. And I thought, well, let's get this done. Let's just go up and say hi. And I walked up and I'm like, hey, Adam. He's like, Marin, Marin, there's Marin. How are you, Marin? And very pleasant interaction. So I did not win. Allison did not win. Glow did not win. Betty did not win. It was an evening of losing for us at our table, but it was nice. And Allison looked pretty and Betty looked pretty and everybody was dressed up. And I honestly, when I saw who I was up against, one of which was Walton Goggins, who I'd like to have on the show, I was like, that guy, that's the guy. That's the guy who should win for vice principals. Are you kidding me? That fucking character was crazy and funny and deep and fucked up. And I had no expectation to win. And I didn't. Walton Goggins won. But this was great. Walton Goggins got up there. He's like, I can't believe I won this. This is great. But like Mark Maron, I'm up against Mark Maron, all these other great actors. Mark Maron, who doesn't love Mark Maron? Walton Goggins said that. And that was very nice of him to say. And I want him on the show. I don't think that was his intention. I'll take him at his word that he enjoyed my performance and that he likes me. But I would like to talk to him in here. So maybe we can make that happen. What's been I mean, that stuff in Hawaii, that false alarm in Hawaii, man, that will be a very memorable vacation for a lot of people. Hope honeymooners who are down in Hawaii, that half hour there must have been a real test of the of your new love. I'll tell you that. I bet you it was a real test for a lot of people that half hour, how you looked at the people you love, your family. I bet you there was a lot of good and a lot of sad revelations in that half hour. A lot of admissions, confessions, behavior in the face of the worst kind of potential adversity. I wonder, I'd like to hear those stories. Someone call Ira Glass and tell him when the time is right to do a story reflecting back on that 35 minutes. Do a This American Life about the stories of the 35 minutes anticipating nuclear annihilation. I'm sure there's some heartbreak, some humor, and just some pure, unfiltered terror that elevated, destroyed, and brought people closer in terms of relationships. I'm going to try not to make it trite by making the jokes that I made on stage last night about the possibilities of what could have happened in those moments with people. And I'm not laughing in a mocking way. It's just a heavy thing to go through. And there's a bit of gratitude we should all feel that our horrendous president was playing golf and probably wasn't informed until after the fact. So he didn't act rashly. I laugh and I breathe when complete and utter discomfort. It's not condescension or laughing at. It's literally just anxiety and complete discomfort. So Tom Segura is here. And I like this guy. I like his wife as well, Christina. She was on just recently. And they're both comedians, but Tom is our guest today. And he's got a new special called Disgraceful. It's now streaming on Netflix. And he dropped by, and this is me talking to Tom Segura. So this special, though, you just did one, right?
I did one that came out in 2016.
Right.
The beginning of 2016.
Yeah. And was that the one that went huge?
I mean, that one really gave me a nice bump. Yeah. I mean, the one before that was not an original, but it was licensed.
What was that one called?
That was called Completely Normal.
Yeah.
And that definitely changed things for me. But it wasn't like...
On the road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like, oh my God, you know, huge. It's just like now the clubs would sell out.
Right.
And but it was also, that was gradual. It wasn't like the next week.
Right.
It was like kind of month by month. I think that is very healthy way to have the progress go.
Right. So, and then the special after that, the last one was called what?
It was called Mostly Stories.
And this one's called?
Disgraceful.
And where'd you shoot it?
I shot it at the Paramount in Denver.
For Netflix?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you say it's gradual. So now you're selling out theaters regular?
Yeah.
Like what size?
I mean.
2,000?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that one was 2,000 seaters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty crazy to me that that's happening.
I played there. I think I played the Paramount in Denver.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I sold them all, but I think it's a nice theater.
It's a beautiful place. Yeah. But I think, I mean, I'm saying that, like, that happened, I feel like, over the course of 3 or 4 years, right?
Where it was, right,
like, clubs, bigger clubs, rock club,
right,
small theater.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, theater. Yeah. Yeah, that's the way it's good, because you kind of see it coming.
Not, yeah, like, yeah.
Here you go.
Yeah.
And also, you still got to work for a living.
Absolutely, man. I felt like I really was hoping that I wouldn't have to. Like,
me too.
I was talking to people about, like, maybe I'll take 2018 off.
Yeah,
that was great. Right. 2017 was dope.
I did it. I'm sitting on some cash.
Yeah.
But then it's so dumb because, like, you think you're not going to do it, but you went and bought the house.
I know.
And you had the baby?
Yep.
How many you got? Two? One?
No, I got one. Yeah.
All right. So, like, you're probably going to have another one.
Probably, maybe. Right? Well, my wife had a dream that you, this week with you.
What?
That she was pregnant in a dream.
Yeah.
And she goes, and then Marc Maron came up to me and was like, that's my kid. And I was like, no more glow for you. Turn that shit off.
I'm sorry, buddy. I don't have no recollection of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had nothing to do with it.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
I know, but then your lifestyle changes.
You up your nut.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Even if you don't plan to do it, it's a weird thing because culture forces you to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you're expected to do it.
Totally.
And the problem with it is when you do it, you're like, this is pretty good.
Of course.
This is sort of, you know, even if you thought you weren't working towards that, it's like, this is what we were working towards.
And isn't it crazy that it takes you to make money to realize you don't have shit as far as money? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, first time you make, like, you know, substantial money, you're like, at the end of the, like, when everything's broken down for you and commissions and taxes, you're like, I don't have shit.
Right.
Like, I have a little left over.
Right.
But, like, I definitely have to go back to work.
You got a kid and a, yeah. How old is that kid?
He's two now. Just turned two.
And your wife's very lovely.
Yes.
She was here. Thank her for the Sartre book. Yeah. I know it was pressing, and she was like, I got to get that to you.
She really emphasized, I have to bring this to you today. I was like, I got it.
Well, you know, she is having my baby, so.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that kid.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, I mean.
You better stop by.
Occasionally. I think you'll do a better job than me.
I don't know.
I think it's the situation is perfect, but if you need my help.
Yeah.
She's doing well too. I mean, her special was great.
It's great, and she just announced, you know, like, it's exciting for me because I feel like I recognize it from my own experience.
Yeah,
that she just, you know, announced some club dates.
Yeah,
and then got a call like, oh, that show sold out. You want to add it? And I was like, oh shit! So I was like, maybe I don't have to work as hard.
Maybe this time off thing's going to pay off.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting.
Well, how have you always balanced that? You know, because I remember talking to her, and I don't know if I talked to you the last time specifically about, you know, being married to a comedian, but it works out.
The thing is, it's always been our norm.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I don't know. It's like,
but do you help each other with jokes? Not really. Right.
Not really. There's
never been envy. You have problems?
No, there'll be things that, like, you know, I feel like a lot of comedy from any comic comes from conversation.
Sure.
Right? You talk to people.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's my bit. Yeah.
So it's like you know, we're talking.
Yeah.
And then she'll be like, that's my shit right there. Like, because she said something.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, oh, yeah. And then, you know, you're kind of adding to the conversation.
Right. Yeah.
So in that sense, that's been happening
forever.
Forever.
Yeah.
You know?
But do you have can I have that? Do you do that?
Yeah, of course.
Can I do that?
Yeah, can I do that?
Yeah.
And then I also have this thing where I go...
It's like living with your writer.
Yeah, if she gives me really big disapproval, I'll be like, that's a good one.
Yeah,
so
right,
like,
right,
if I say something, she's like, ugh. And I'm like, that's in the act.
That's in the keeper.
Yeah, that's a keeper for sure. Because you disapprove so hard.
Well, I guess what's good is that you're both doing well.
Like, yeah.
I mean, if she wasn't doing well, it might be a different situation.
That's true.
Yeah.
Or if I wasn't, oh my God, I'm sure I'd be like so depressed about it.
Right. But getting back to that whole idea of like being here, of like finding the popularity. So you don't like, it was just, you just put those specials out there and it happened. And that's what did it.
Yeah.
It's wild, right?
Yeah, it's totally wild, man.
People just started coming around.
Yeah.
Do they all kind of, do you know your fans? Do you know the type of people that come? Is it a broad swath of people?
It's somewhat broad.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's mostly, I'm lucky that it's in, you know.
Grown-ups?
It's grown-ups. They're kind of in that ideal age range of like late 20s to early 40s.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, one thing, this sounds like a brag, but we talk about it. Christina and I both have been told by a lot of staff, like at venues.
They tip good?
They're like, your fans are polite. They are laughers. They tip well. And like that makes us feel like,
yeah, I get that too. It's great. Like, yeah, they're grownups.
Like, yeah, you have like good, they're like, you have good fans.
And they might hang out for a while. If you keep doing new shit,
yeah,
you might hold them because they're obviously, some of them have families, they're taking time off, and they're getting a sitter to go see you. They're not just kids that are going to stop giving a shit about you in 2 years when they're out of college.
Yeah, they're kind of, they're like, like a following. Right?
Yeah,
so,
right.
Yeah, so now.
But you can hold them because they're nice. They're grownups.
And now I have this familiar, I'm sure you definitely have to be kind of in it too, because yours came out a few months, not that long ago, a few months ago.
Right.
Where it's like the thing's out and you're like, God damn it.
Now they're out.
And I know, the thing is, the feeling is the same, the anxiety.
Which one?
The anxiety of like, I'm back to zero.
Yeah, I got to do another hour.
But at least it's familiar. In other words, I recognize it from the previous hours.
Yeah, you know, like I didn't know where the last one was going to come from. I really didn't know.
And then you do it a bit at a time, right? Like you just kind of.
Well, what I would do is, you do it a bit at a time, but then you find like, you know, you get that like 15 or 20 of new shit that's really working. You kind of play out. But like what I used to do is I used to go over to the Steve Allen and just book out, you know, 4 Tuesdays in a month and just run through whatever I'm thinking. Just improvise an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Record it?
Yeah. And just think through shit. And see what builds. Like, it's weird though. Like every time you're up against it does come. I don't know how. You know, I don't know. I got to get a new one, but I have no plans to do a special. But I got to tour a little bit.
Yeah,
this is what my new brain did. The old brain wouldn't have done this. My new brain was like, you know, I did a lot of stuff that nobody saw. Like I did a lot of stuff over the years before I was popular, or like that, like my epic special. Not many people saw that.
Yeah.
So like, why don't I do just sort of a greatest hits?
There
thing?
You go. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, of course. Oh, I love that part of the brain. Yeah. I'm like, I have a whole CD that no one ever fucking heard.
No one ever heard. Did you take it out? Did you do it? I mean, did you do that? I don't do it either. Like, because like those bits die in your head.
Totally.
It's weird.
It's so funny to me too, where when people are like, are you going to do this tonight? Are you going to, or like, why didn't you do that bit? And I'm like,
you know it. Why would you ask? You wanted to see the bit that you like?
I did, by the way. I got so, and I'm people, you know, people get in your head on this last tour.
Yeah.
They were like, you should do an encore of like,
big bit.
Yeah, of like these five bits that people love.
That's not bad.
So I was like, all right, man. I go, I just don't feel comfortable doing it. You know, I was just being honest. I was like, I don't feel. And then I did a show somewhere, I forget, where I was like, all right, I'll do it. And so I went out and I was like, people have asked me to do this, so I'm going to do it. And I started an old bit. Humongous ovation. And then did the bit, complete silence. Like, no laughs.
Yeah.
They know the bit. And then at the end, applause.
Yeah.
I was like, it's like a fucking performing for my grandmother or something. Like, what are you talking? I was like, that was horrible.
But were they happy?
But I mean, like, there were no laughs. Like, the part where I used to get laughs, they were like, yeah, I know this part. I know this is a funny part, but
why would I
know it. Yeah.
It's nice for him to do it.
Yeah.
I've never seen it live.
It felt so uncomfortable. I was like, I'm fucking never doing that again.
Never again.
I mean, to me, it felt very uncomfortable.
Like, here's the thing with me. Like, I know there's a bit that's about a 12-minute bit that I worked really hard on for, like, months. And I never made it onto a special. And I did it once on a TV, like, on John Oliver's stand-up thing.
You're good to do that, though.
Right?
Definitely.
Yeah, it's like a big piece.
Oh, for sure.
It was in my book, though, too. But then I just don't know.
No, that's fine.
Right?
Yes.
And now I got to get back up. I got to get it back up on its feet.
That's fine. That'll feel like fun work to do.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, I got to go watch it.
Yeah.
I find the tapes.
I did a private event last year where this, you know, corporate guys, and they were like party guys. I was like, why are you hiring me for a corporate event? And they were like, we're big fans from Texas and blah, blah, blah. And I fly out and I do, and I'm like meeting them 5 hours before the show.
Yeah.
And they're like, I was like, so just be clear, like, you know, I'm just going to do what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
When I do this show tonight.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, we were hoping that you would do this, 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 and this, like all like five old bits. And I was like, all right. And they're like, I mean, is that a problem? I'm like, I mean, I kind of forgot them, but I'll go work on it. So I went to Netflix. I brought up the special.
Really?
Then I bought the album on my phone.
You bought your own album?
I bought my own album, yeah. Which is horrible because now it plays in my shuffle sometimes, like on my car. I'm like, God damn it. I hear my own voice doing stand-up.
Is that weird? Mine's in my shuffle, too.
Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah. What is this? Oh, my God.
But you forget that, like, you forget the beats and, like, the pauses.
Right.
All that stuff that becomes muscle memory.
Yeah.
And so I was, yeah, I mean, just doing it.
Did you load up? Did you, were able to load up?
I was able to do a few of them, yeah, yeah. But I knew when I was doing that I was like, you know, I was forgetting like a tag here.
Right. Well, that's the weirdest thing is like when you get off and you're like, I forgot the hinge to the joke.
Yeah.
I missed the whole middle.
Yeah.
So so it's New Year's. Did you do anything? Is anything going to change in your mind? Do you do resolutions?
No.
I didn't do any. I didn't even think about it. I went to bed at 10. I didn't even fucking, did you work?
No.
I don't work on New Year's.
That felt like a huge accomplishment.
When you decide not to work on New Year's?
Yeah,
it's the best thing.
I haven't done it now in a couple of years.
Me
I talked
neither.
To.
I've done the early show. Sometimes I'll do the Comedy Store at like 8, but not. I want to be home before the weirdness starts.
I don't want to be out with the animals at all.
Oh, no. Are you fucking kidding me?
I talked to Joey Diaz the other day, and I go, he just checks in, you know, how you doing?
Yeah.
And then I was like, he was like, yeah, I went down to Huntington Beach for New Year's. I go, oh, you worked that new room there? He's like, who the fuck do you think you're talking to? I'm not a fucking animal. And I was like, what? He's like, I don't work New Year's. I'm not a pig. And I was like, all right. And he was like, no, I got a hotel with the wife and the kid. I was like, okay. I just was asking.
He got took offense.
Took offense that I suggested he work New Year's.
A lot of people do, I guess. Like, but I think some people make a fortune. But if you,
yeah.
But the idea, like, I'm going to do a spot at the store.
Yeah.
You know, for $400.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's not, it's just not, I don't know, whatever. I don't even know if it's that much.
I remember 10 years ago hearing, it was like folklore about New Year's pay for people, you know?
Like, right, right.
Like people, I'm like, yeah. you win the fucking lottery on New Year's?
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
Then.
Wait, you get $1 million?
That's fucking crazy.
For two shows?
That's nuts. Yeah. I remember featuring like 10 plus years ago on New Year's and then.
For who?
Fucking, it was a club weekend.
The guy making the huge money?
No. It wasn't like for a huge money thing, but. It was, I think it was 6 shows.
Yeah.
And instead of $100 a show, which is like the standard feature pay, they were going to pay me $1,000 for 6 shows.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is crazy.
This is nuts.
This is real money, dude.
I made it.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm $1,000 a show guy on New Year's.
That's fucking crazy.
It is crazy at that point. It's exciting.
When you're making, like, when you're a headliner and you're like a $1,500 a week act, and they're like, New Year's is $2,500.
Great.
If I could just get this regularly.
Yeah. And then you realize the babysitting job involved.
Yeah.
And that managing, you know, from 11:15 to 12:30, fuck that.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
Fuck it.
You just feel it getting out of control and the wait staff is like getting the hats out.
It's horrible, dude.
And I can't.
And you can't police. Because like they paid like $80 or $100 or something.
Oh, you can't be a dick.
You can't. I mean, I remember one time I did a club in Seattle.
You gotta be considerate that night.
Yeah,
they paid some money.
And I'm like doing.
You want to ruin their night?
Doing the show, and I'm like telling some guy to shut the fuck up. And then the guy that runs the place was like, "You're a funny guy, but I don't think you're a New Year's act." That's what he told me after the show.
Thank God.
And I was like, okay. I was like, sorry that I wanted them to listen to the show.
Yeah, but that was your misunderstanding.
Like, he's like, they fucking paid a fortune to be here. I'm like, dude, they're like screaming.
Yeah.
He's like, blowing their horns.
Right, that's what a New Year's act has to deal with.
Like, nah, dude.
Can't do it.
Call Bert. Don't fucking call me.
Who's Bert? Oh, it's Bert Kreischer.
Mm-hmm.
Let him do it. He'll take his
shirt
off.
He'll love to do it.
Yeah, it'd be a thing. I haven't watched him in a long time. Are you guys buddies?
Oh, we're good friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're good friends.
Hey, what does he do out there?
He's a party guy.
I just see pictures of him in different, less clothing, some clothing.
Dude, he's going to be nude soon, and it's going to be perfectly acceptable.
Everyone's going to be okay with it.
That's a Speedo show, for sure.
Well, that's where it's going, right?
Of course.
On his fourth special. Like, it's time.
Yeah.
Time has come.
Dude, take some shit off. More off. Yeah, he's almost naked.
So the kids too. Now, how do you manage that with the? Do you, Is she, does Christina travel with you or no? She's her own headliner.
Yeah.
She doesn't need to do that anymore. Mm-mm. Did she ever do that? She did a little bit.
We did, a handful of dates, but not regularly.
But how do you deal with the kid on the, who watches
No,
that?
And we never, I mean, we're so one of us is always home.
Oh,
you know,
you plan it that way?
Oh, yeah.
Well, congrats on the new special.
Thanks, man.
It's great seeing you. Thank you again for bringing the book.
Thanks for getting my wife pregnant in her dreams.
Yeah, I just want to help people. That's really.
She said she shut you down, but like, I was like, I think you're just saying that now. I don't think you're being honest about that.
Because she realized she probably shouldn't have told you any of it.
Yeah. She was like, Mark said, like it's his kid, and I'm like, uh huh. And what did you say? She's like, I told him, hell no. I don't know what you're talking about. And I was like, uh huh.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, I didn't want to cause any trouble.
It's funny because she's the type, I don't know of how many women you've had this, like that actually will get in a bad mood about shit they dreamed.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Like, no. I've had her be like, hey, I'm like, what's up with you today? And she's like, oh, nothing. You were just a total dick in this dream. And you were like with this brunette girl. And I was like, in a dream you had? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, are you mad at me for your dream? And she's like, I'm not happy about it. And I'm like, you're carrying this into the real world right now? What are you talking about? Why would you, like, I'm not involved in this at all. She's like, yes, you were totally, totally rude. And you were flirting really. I'm like, what is going on?
And how long does that go on for?
I mean, it's gone on for like long mornings, you know, where it's like in the afternoon. She's like, I forgive you. And I'm like, forgive me? What are you talking about?
Oh, my God. Yeah, my girlfriend gets a little creeped out by things, but she'll lean into the horoscope a little bit, which is, you know, she's got a...
I'm working on a bit about...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, about superstitious people in general.
Oh, really?
And people who believe in horoscopes.
Well, because they have the ones that they read. It's not a general thing. They, like, she's got, like, because I don't really go in for it.
Yeah.
Right, but she's like, but this woman who does it, like, I was referred to her by someone else, and it's really... on the money. And I'm like, what?
It's so crazy. My favorite part of it is just when it's like, yeah. And then it says here that people who get angry and then they're like, and you're like, you mean that I have one of five shared traits among human beings?
Well, there's that, right? There's the sort of like, of course they're going to match something up if you just, you know, scattershot, like you're just throwing a bunch of shit out.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, look at this one thing.
Yeah.
Out of the seven other options.
That's
right on the money.
This one right here, it's all you. And you're like, yeah, everyone falls into that category.
Yeah, it's a weird thing when the brain wants to have a handle on stuff because it just can't. Fuck.
Fuck.
Yeah. All right, buddy.
All right.
Talk to you soon. All right, that was fun. That was a fun dream. That is, maybe I should just leave it where it is. Now I want to know about that. I want to know the dream, but I don't think that's appropriate for me to reach out and find out details about the dream. So Tom Segura, Disgraceful, now streaming on Netflix. So I've always been impressed with Laurie Metcalf's work, and I'm fascinated and know very little about the Steppenwolf Theater Company in Chicago. It's sort of a mythic place. It's been mentioned here a few times by people in passing. I guess really probably by Michael Shannon, some other people. But Laurie Metcalf is one of the original members and founders of the Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. And I was excited to talk to her about that, and I did. She was brilliant in Lady Bird. She was a transcendent in Louis C.K.'s Horace and Pete, obviously great on Roseanne, but really, as of late, just doing completely mesmerizing, mind-blowing performances, and she was great in Lady Bird. So she's also up for a SAG Award. She was at the Critics' Choice and did not win. She's nominated for two Screen Actors Guild Awards. She's also back for the revival of Roseanne, which I will talk about with her, which will premiere on ABC in March. This is me and the amazing Laurie Metcalf here in the original garage. It's been crazy, huh?
I had no idea.
You had no idea? You had no idea it would be so crazy?
No, I didn't. I'm used to, you know, wrapping a play, having a little toast afterwards, and, you know, bye-bye, go back to the corporate apartment, pack my suitcase, and fly home.
Yeah. So wait, but so this is the first time in years that you've been involved, or you've never been involved with something like this?
I've never been involved.
Oh, in something like this?
No, never. No, I did a small part in a movie 10 years ago, and then the last movie I did before that was probably another 10 years ago.
So it's been that long?
Yeah.
Since you've done major film. Motion picture? Yeah. Film at all?
Film at all.
But yeah. Didn't you do some voices?
Oh, yeah. Toy Story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's different.
Yeah.
Yeah. So really, it's been like, what, 20 years, give or take, since you've done a movie?
Yeah.
It's so weird because I remember seeing you. I remember one time many years ago. I don't remember. Was it Internal Affairs?
Yes.
Where you played the cop?
Yeah.
Like, and I remember, like, that's that woman who's, she can really act. She's the
woman,
one,
what,
TV.
From Roseanne?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, right. I mean, you must have got that all the time.
The woman from Roseanne, yeah, right. Jackie from Roseanne. Yeah. That reached a lot of people over the years.
Right. But it's so weird because the way you inhabit characters, like it seemed like two different people. But I remember that movie. That was a dark movie.
Yeah. It was interesting. I loved, that was one of the first movies I did. And Mike Figgis directed it, and the part was written for a man. And for some reason, he just decided to cast me. And, I remember a scene in the movie where Andy Garcia and I are sitting in a convertible and a woman walks by. So it would have been the man looking her over, but instead I got to
check her out.
Right. You know, yeah. So it just made it a little more interesting.
A bold move on Mike Figgis' part.
Yeah.
But it was like that was the one with Richard Gere, right?
Right.
And he was the creepy cop.
Right. That was the first time Richard Gere probably got to play a bad guy.
Right. And he shoots you, doesn't he?
Yeah, he shot me in the stomach.
In the stomach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to go back and look at that. I haven't. I don't think I ever saw it. I don't think I ever watched it.
Really?
No. I have a phobia about watching things because in my head they look so different.
Uh huh.
They seem so different.
But this, I guess the thing that really was astonishing that recently was when he did Louis, Horace, and Pete.
Oh.
And like that monologue, it was sort of...
Writing of that thing, I still can't get over it.
I was sending it to people. I'm like, have you seen this?
Uh-huh.
specifically your part.
Yeah.
And I think that brought you to a lot of people's attention in the sense of like, where has she been? Did you feel that?
Yeah, because it was... firstly, it was so well written.
Uh-huh.
I was amazed when I first read it. It came to me... I remember I was in a dressing room on Broadway, and I got a little packet, and it said Horace and Pete, but somehow it was tied to Louis C.K., so I didn't know how. I didn't know if he had written it or if he was going to be the other actor in the scene or if he was just producing it. It turns out he did he did all those, you know, but it was a secret project at the time. So, and then I read it and I was blown away by the depth of the scene between the divorced couple.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And how they, as friends, had just kept raising their children together, even though they were... had a horrible, bitter breakup.
Right.
It was so well crafted.
Because it really is just that one scene, isn't it?
Yes, that was the whole episode.
Yeah.
In the arc of 10, that was episode 3.
Yeah,
it was just two people sitting at a table.
For like 35, 40 minutes?
Yeah, and it's such a gift to be able to do something that tiny.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I had been doing a lot of theater and playing to these thousand-seat houses.
Yeah.
But to bring it in that small and just to be able to, you know, see every little twitch in somebody's face that you're opposite of.
Right.
Oh, that was one of the hardest things I ever worked on and the most rewarding at the same time.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And you were on stage simultaneously in New York at that time?
Yeah.
What were you doing on stage?
I was doing Misery with Bruce Willis.
Oh yeah, how was that experience?
That was odd. that was not a play, it wasn't a movie, and it wasn't a book anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't know what it was, but we did it 8 times a week.
For a while?
Yeah, for 4 months.
It did well?
It did really well. I mean, it had sold out houses.
Did you get along with him?
I got along great with him. He's a fantastic guy. He's super generous, and he worked his ass off.
Oh yeah.
I didn't know, you know, if he had done a play about 40 years?
Oh, yeah.
Earlier?
Yeah.
He had stepped in Fool for Love for Ed Harris, a Sam Shepard play. He was the understudy, and he got to perform it for a while. So that's the last time he'd been on stage.
So that was probably his first job as an actor almost, when he was still like bartending in
New
York?
Back then, yes.
Right.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
And I was in New York doing a play called Balm and Gilead at the same time. It was a really cool time to be in New York during that, because Mamet was doing stuff and everything was really gritty. And
yeah.
It was so fun. But what was I saying about...
You were working on Misery.
Yeah. Here's why it was such an odd duck. It was because... most of the people who came to see it had never been to a play before.
Right.
You know.
Well, that's what Broadway is a little bit now.
So they get to cross that off their list. They get to see Bruce, the movie star, off their list.
Yeah.
If they could have sold popcorn at the thing, they would have.
Sure.
And they were just really, really excited to be there. Did the play work as a play? No.
Yeah.
But I had to wrap my head around the fact that it wasn't ever going to be what I hoped it would be, but people loved it.
Right. It was an entertainment.
Yeah.
And was it, who conceived the play? I mean, was it put together wrong? Was it written weirdly? Because it's a Stephen King story.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So did they take the play from the movie? How does that work? Do you know?
They took it mostly from the movie.
Right.
They felt like they had to. They felt like there had to be certain scenes and famous lines from
right,
it. Had to be in there, that people are coming to see the hobbling scene or whatever you want to.
Yeah. And, sure.
But when I went back and read the book, I was like, oh, why aren't we incorporating this really juicy stuff?
You know?
So it was just an odd animal.
So by the time you got the Horace and Pete, did you do that in a day?
We did it in a few hours, but it took me a month to learn it.
Uh-huh.
It was hard to learn.
Uh-huh.
So I would, in between, like, on matinee days, in between shows, I would just drill those lines over and over and over again, because I knew it was my responsibility to know it backwards and forwards, because I knew he would want to shoot it in basically one take.
Yeah, I couldn't just the look in your eyes and the intensity of the whole thing. It was completely devastating.
Well, you know, it starts with the material. What can I say? And he was a fantastic scene partner.
Yeah, yeah,
fantastic.
So what, can we talk about where you come from?
Yeah.
When you grew up in Illinois?
Southern Illinois, yeah.
Yeah, like what part?
Born in Carbondale.
Yeah.
Home of SIU, SIU Carbondale, and then we transferred to SIU Edwardsville.
Well, your father was in the college business?
He was a comptroller for it. That's why I think of the college when I think of the hometown.
Yeah.
But so Southern Illinois, and went to, you know, like in Lady Bird's dreams are to, you know, get out of there and go as far away as she possibly could.
Right.
I didn't have the foresight to get as far away as I could, but I went to from Southern Illinois to Mid Illinois, and went to Illinois State University, and thought, who are all these people with the heavy, heavy accent that I'm hearing? And it was just people who had come down from Chicago.
Oh, really?
I had no idea.
That people talk like that?
Yeah. Well, or that, to me, that was a foreign land.
And were you interested in acting early? I mean, do you have brothers and sisters?
One brother and one sister.
Are they in show business?
No. Nobody from my family was. Nobody from Southern Illinois was that I knew of.
Yeah.
And I didn't have hopes to do it either. I was way too practical to think that I would ever be able to make a living at it. So
it was just a dream early on?
I was curious about it, because I was very shy.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I got up the nerve to audition for a play in high school, and I got in, and I felt like I could hide behind the character, so I felt kind of loose on stage.
Right. Get lost in it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And yes, it was a comfortable feeling to be up there. You'd think for a shy person, it would have shaken them to their core to have to be up there performing.
Yeah.
But it was the opposite for me, because I felt like I could hide.
So early on, it was a transformative experience.
Like, yes.
Like that.
Yeah.
You actually were able to get lost in the part out of necessity, and it was a relief.
Yes. I got a laugh, which was mesmerizing to me, and the hook. Then I was hooked.
Right.
But because I thought, oh, I got it accidentally.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought, oh, I want to get it again. So I have to deconstruct it and see what I did. Can I do that? And I think I did figure it out. And then from then on, it was like, here comes my laugh.
Yeah,
you know, and
addicting.
Yes, it's addicting. It's a real rush, especially when you're in control of it.
Right, right. Well, that Harry Shearer once said to me that the reason people do comedy is to control why people are laughing at them.
Yes. Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's what I was kind of hiding from.
Right,
you know?
Right. So it's empowering.
It is empowering. It still is to this day.
To get laughs?
And just to own a stage.
Right.
You know, because that's where I feel most comfortable.
But do you have any of that shyness still? Or is that gone?
I think the theater crowd that I fell in with sort of drained it out of me. You know, I had to learn how to hold my own around those freaks.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of interesting, the whole sort of story of it. So you did it first in high school, and then you went to college did you study practical things, or did you study theater?
Well, I thought it was I was being practical. I studied German, and I thought, I will be a translator. You
for
know,
German.
And then
there's such a big calling for German translators.
I know.
There's never a shortage of jobs.
I don't know what I was thinking. I actually did think that was practical. And then I switched to anthropology. I don't know what I thought.
Good jump. Saved it at the last minute. I'm really going to take care of it.
Sideways move a little bit, you know.
But it is sort of interesting.
Right.
I mean, like in terms of, like, did you get a handle on German?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I've forgotten it all now.
Right.
But, you know, when I look back, both those things had to do with communication, literally interpreting, which is what I feel like I do now.
And also about language.
Yes,
you know,
language.
When you study a language, you really are able to deconstruct a language and figure out the power of it, you know?
And then studying behavior with the anthropological side.
Yeah.
So it was kind of my early steps, you know, jumping on this
wagon. Sure. You kind of loaded up your brain, you know, in a way.
Yeah, well, it was just interest that I had.
Yeah.
Without even knowing.
And German's a very interesting language. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of weird words in German for weird things.
Yes, I like how it definitely follows the rules.
Yeah.
There is no rule breaking allowed.
Right, but they seem to have descriptions and adjectives that don't exist anywhere else but in German.
Yes, and they put words together to form another word.
Right, that makes sense.
Yes.
Logical.
It does.
And anthropology, did you get a degree in anthropology in German?
No. I ended up falling in with that theater crowd.
In college.
Yeah, and I left a semester early.
Really?
Yeah. I went back and got my degree.
One semester?
Huh?
One semester.
But I went back and got it, you know.
But that's funny. You must have been really into what you were doing.
Well, the plan was that there were a group of us that were going to go up to Highland Park, Illinois, and do theater for a summer. It was only going to be for a summer.
Who was in this group?
This was Gary Sinise, Jeff Perry, and John Malkovich.
You were in college with all those guys?
Yes. Yeah, I met them there.
And they were already doing theater in college?
We were all, doing it, not together.
But was anyone in the program, the theater program? What, was it University of Illinois?
It was Illinois State.
Illinois State, yeah.
We had seen each other's work. I will say that a few of us were dating, you know?
Yeah.
So,
that's all you're going to say? You ended up marrying somebody, didn't you?
Yeah. I ended up marrying Jeff Perry.
Right.
Yeah. But John and I were dating at the time. We were an inbred little bunch.
Well, John, I can't imagine what he was like in college. I can only imagine it must've been a higher octane. Fueled by, like I imagine the quest for, self must have been quite a rough ride with that guy.
When John hit the scene, at college, he sparked a lot of conversation because his presence was a bit off and everybody was trying to figure him out. And I think he enjoyed that very much.
Did he come from Illinois?
Yeah, Southern Illinois, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
So, okay, so you and John are dating. It's Gary Sinise and Jeff Perry, the four of you, drop out.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to go do theater.
Uh-huh, in a church basement with 88 seats.
In Highland Park?
In Highland Park. And we did four one-acts. And then I went back to school and they continued. They did another play that didn't do much. But very slowly over the years that we were in that basement, people in Chicago, critics started to take notice of us, and they would drive up. And
but you're all like 20?
Mm-hmm.
20 years old?
Yeah. They would buy their $3 ticket and watch us do Glass Menagerie in the basement.
Huh.
And that's the one that actually they really set up and thought that we were worth making the drive for. The Glass Menagerie was a really strong production.
Oh, who was in it? Who was directing?
I was Laura.
Yeah.
And John was Tom, and the gentleman caller was Terry Kinney. I forgot to mention Terry.
He went to college with you too?
Yes.
So it was you.
I started off first dating Terry. Yeah.
I think he's a great actor.
Yeah, he is.
Okay, so you're in a church basement, Glass Menagerie.
Mm-hmm.
And
so that one really started the ball rolling in a way. And so it was, you know, I tell you, when I decided to quit my day job.
Which was?
Secretary. I could type really fast.
Through college, you were a secretary?
Yeah. And when we were starting the company.
You can still type really fast, I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good skill to have.
It is.
Yeah.
That's when I knew that, oh, well, okay, being practical is one thing, but I think I really am going to try and, you know, make a living at this. Of course, I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't been with a group. I think right. I would have started off too thin-skinned, and I wouldn't have been ambitious enough to do it on my own.
Right, but that crew, was there, like, because Steppenwolf seems to be sort of a defining experience for people. I mean, as time goes on, when did Joan Allen come in?
When we were still in the basement.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So
Glenn Headley.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
So when did it sort of like, because how much did you really know about acting, you know, by the time you dropped out of school? I mean, what?
Yeah, not much at all. I'd taken a couple of classes. But what happened with our group was that we just wanted to, we challenged each other in ways like just only wanting to make each other laugh.
Uh-huh.
Or make each other, we wanted to work. It was all about the work.
Yeah.
And we were all the same age.
Yeah.
So whatever show that we picked to do, somebody had to either play older or play younger.
Right.
You know, and that made you stretch in a way that you wouldn't have gotten the chance to otherwise. You would have always just been cast as, you know, what you look right for and what your right age is. But this stretched us in other weird ways.
And who was the director? I mean, who was...
We took turns directing. If you were the director, that means that you had drawn the short end of the stick.
Uh-huh.
Because nobody wanted to direct. Everybody just wanted to be on the stage with each other.
And it was a collective spirit. There was nobody in charge. You know, you were all founders.
Yes.
You're like one of the founders of Steppenwolf?
Yeah. I mean, we would name somebody artistic director for a while until they burnt out, but that was only sort of to go after grant money and things like that.
Oh, right. It wasn't an actual job?
No, we all decided what our seasons would look like and who cast ourselves.
So you're telling me that, like, you know, all of you guys were like 20 years old or so, and whatever training you had was just by virtue of your age limited.
Yeah.
And you evolved together to figure out how to act?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. We had a common sense of humor.
Uh-huh.
And drive.
Uh-huh.
And we got lucky in some of our play selections, like with True West, something like that.
But no one ever came in, no Buddha, no Zen, no guru, no acting coach, no, like, you just kind of, you defined it.
Yeah.
No one was studying acting?
No.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. We got really, really lucky that way. And we were all also lucky in the sense that everybody left us alone. We were just a little group up in a Chicago suburb with, you know, friends and family buying their $3 ticket to come see us.
Uh-huh.
And so nobody had swooped in and said, I'm going to pluck you out and you out, and we're going to New York and L.A.
Right.
You know, so we spent years just together, just working together.
Doing plays.
Yeah, back to back, yeah.
And what was the sort of, like, outside of making each other laugh or challenging each other, it seems that over time, the people that came out of Steppenwolf, you know, have a unique intensity to them, you know, bordering on rage in some cases.
Yes, that was a common trait also. I don't know. I think it's that maybe it's that we were so passionate about theater itself and about the work that it could come off like that.
Yeah.
You know, we could be it. We didn't have to be doing a scene where there was yelling, but there was still this passion humming underneath it, you know. So I think that it, long, long ago, they were calling it rock and roll theater.
Yeah. But there was yelling.
Yeah. That's fun.
Did you choose plays that it required that type of intensity?
We didn't. We weren't really savvy enough to know very many plays. I remember us, you know, like going to the library and checking out best plays of, you know, 1975.
No,
we didn't.
Kidding.
We didn't have resources,
right?
You know,
yeah.
So our selections weren't always the best,
right?
But we you know. Play, we did, committed to him 150%.
Right. Did you do like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and
no,
stuff like
no.
What were some of the early plays?
Well,
outside
the early of- the saddest image I can give you is in the very first 4-1 acts that we did, Jeff Perry and I were paired up and we did The Lover by Pinter.
Right.
And that is a mature couple who you think they're cheating on each other,
but actually
they're just playing sexual games with each other, because he goes off to work and then he shows up later in different clothes and they pretend that she's the mistress and it's just their way of, you know, having sex.
Right,
and, So we were so naive to have chosen that, and it was such a misguided choice. But I remember because Jeff had a sad little glued-on mustache to make him look older,
right.
And I don't know what I thought I was doing. It was so wrong-headed, but I just remember looking at him in the basement on the stage, and the, you know, the lights were 2 feet above our head. It's sweltering in there.
Yeah.
People are on folding chairs watching us mutilate this
Pinter
brilliant
play.
Pinter one act, and his mustache is curling up because of the heat. Dreadful.
Did that get bad press? Were people still excited?
I don't think anybody ever reviewed those. We had nobody knew what we were up to in the basement.
Like, what year is this now? Are we talking mid-70s?
Yeah, 73, 74, 76.
So like the arts were vital, you know, like for people to go out to Highland Park from Chicago because a bunch of 20-year-olds are doing theater in a church basement. It seems insane now.
Well, yeah, that took a couple of years.
Right.
Until they were willing to make the drive.
So you guys were just...
Into the word of mouth.
Right, you know, kept working, and you kept doing stuff, and then, you know, it got a buzz. So, you know, people were like, have you heard about this? You know, so people were coming, right? Were you guys performing for 5 people sometimes, 4 people,
sometimes.
9 people?
Yeah. And really, it was family and friends.
Uh-huh.
At the beginning.
Uh-huh.
You know, we thought, oh, we've got to get some more seats in here. Let's do some PR. What can we do? And I think there was a 4th of July parade downtown Highland Park. And so we somehow were on the fire truck waving at people with a Steppenwolf sign.
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. So what was the evolution of Steppenwolf? It moved from the church basement to where?
To Jane Addams Hull House within Chicago, and so we rented it, but it had more seats, and we were in the city. And then the big step was, well, I'm sorry. And then from there we took over an existing theater called St. Nicholas.
Uh-huh.
They folded, and we moved in slightly bigger.
Yeah,
still with the 8-foot ceilings, but. What are you going to do?
Right.
And then after that, we got a board and were able to raise enough money to actually build our theater, which we're still in.
So then you had an art director who was actually an art director, and
yeah,
that kind of stuff sort of filled out.
We resisted, you know, becoming that formal, I guess, for a long time, but we had to.
But still, all the originals, everyone who has been in, you're all members of Steppenwolf Theater, right? And then there was never classes or anything offered. It's still a theater ensemble. How does one get in it?
You get in it by having you know, worked on stage a number of times. And then at the beginning, we were desperate to find new members because we were just so small that it limited what we...
There was like six of you?
Seven, I think, at the beginning.
And when did John Mahoney come in?
Oh, Mahoney came in while we were still in the basement.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, early days, yeah.
Because he seems like he could muster up some angry funny.
Yeah, that's right. See, he fit in.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had that. We could smell it on him. But we were desperate to find new additions for a while. And then, so usually now people get invited in who have worked there a number of times and have the same common, you know, mindset.
Oh, so they'll cast some people that seem right.
Always have to cast outside people to fill in parts.
Right, and if somebody...
And it's harder now for people who have moved away to come back and commit to a show. It's harder, so, you know, it's a long time commitment.
Uh-huh.
And I think the last time I performed there was about 5 years ago now.
Right, because you got to do a run.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that can be like a long, you know.
Yeah, generally 4 months.
Does the original crew ever get together?
We haven't. No, but I know that it would seem like no time had passed at all.
Yeah.
I mean, we see each other here and there when we're in New York and go to each other's work. You know,
I saw Malkovich and Burn This on Broadway.
Yep.
That's pretty crazy.
Yep.
That seemed like the perfect role for him.
Him and Joan.
And you, no, Joan, did I see, was she the other, maybe... I haven't seen her in a while. She did it in the original. And you did Balm and Gilead?
Yeah, that was a big move for us. That really got spread a lot of word about us because
so that
the play
was a Steppenwolf production.
Yeah, it was so successful.
And it moved to New York?
Yes.
And then did you do it in Britain too?
Nope.
Mm-mm. But so that puts you on the map.
That was a big one.
The Steppenwolf Theater's production of Balm and Gilead.
Yeah, that was the rock and roll age. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was so fun to be there then.
Oh, it must have been so exciting. A big, huge break. And you weren't in the basement, though, at that point, were you?
No.
No. But you were not at the one you have now, but the one before that.
Right.
Yeah. So that was like, you're like, we did it. And how long did
we
run?
We got to New York, yeah.
You got to Broadway?
It's the longest run I've ever been in. It was 9 months.
Wow. Who was in it with you?
It was always off Broadway.
Oh, off. Who was in it with you?
Gary Sinise was in it. Jeff Perry was in it. Terry was in it. John directed it.
Uh-huh.
Glenn Headley was in it. Joan was in it. They didn't do the move. This was originally when we did it in Chicago.
Yeah.
Not everybody made the move.
Right.
Some people stayed behind to, you know, keep doing plays in Chicago.
Right. So he directed the New York?
He directed all the versions of it.
Huh.
Yeah.
Did he end up directing a lot?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some people... We got really lucky that some of the actors in the company were really strong directors, even though they didn't really want to do it.
Right.
But I don't know if you knew, but some of the music that we used in Balm and Gilead, we had Ricky Lee Jones' song there. We had Tom Waits and Bruce Springsteen, and they all came to see the play. Talk about a rush.
That's fucking great.
Yeah.
But like Tracy Letts, like in Lady Bird, you work with him, but did you know him? Because he's late to Steppenwolf, right?
Yeah, but still, we've known each other we figured it was 30 years. Just
really?
Known each other. Yeah, but we'd never worked together before.
How'd you know each other for 30 years?
Just through theater in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
But, I can't, we've always tried to find a play to do together and never happened. And it took the movie for us to be able to play husband and wife.
That's so beautiful, though, because you have that dynamic. You have that deep emotional connection.
Yeah,
history.
We did. It made it really simple.
And surprisingly, he's the nice guy in the movie.
Yeah. He's the observer. That's for sure. He doesn't dare go near that mother-daughter relationship.
But he gets burned. But he loves her, the daughter, and both of them in his own way. And he's sweetness to that guy.
Yes. Oh,
the
yeah.
The beaten husband and father.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it like working with him?
It was fantastic. He's like a rock, you know, because he's so present. And I've always loved his style. It's very minimal.
Uh-huh.
It's very clean.
He's also like got a great capacity to be funny.
Yep.
Like he, you know, I can, you know, like it's interesting to see him. Like I saw him in He did. Oh, in Divorce. That's what I saw him in.
Yeah.
And he's, it's a funny character, that character.
Yeah.
And I've seen some of his plays. I saw Osage County, and I saw Bug. I saw what Friedkin did to Bug anyways with Michael Shannon.
I'm fascinated by writers. I mean, because that's where it all comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how they do what they do.
Yeah.
So I'm always quizzing Tracy on, you know, how he comes up with stuff. And
well, what is your process, though, when you talk about, like, even for Horace and Pete and probably for, well, Lady Bird was not improvised. Lady Bird was a scripted film.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I see you do that kind of stuff, which is totally immersive, like, they're both very different, but I find that both those, the Horace and Pete character and the Lady Bird character, you know, there's a trouble in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What is your process as an actor, you know, to what do you do?
Well, I take my clues first off from the material.
So obviously. You get the script for Lady Bird.
Yeah.
And you were, it was written for you? Did she have you in mind?
No. But I felt a connection with it when I read it, which is always a great sign.
Uh-huh.
And I could relate to the conflict, the mother-daughter conflict
right.
in it, because I've been through three teenagers with another one about to burst.
You have four kids?
Uh-huh. And so I that was really relatable.
Uh-huh.
But what I also appreciated in the writing, and I knew that Greta put it in there very delicately, were these little moments of heart throughout the movie that go a long way when basically every scene that you're in is like a battle.
Right.
But they can, you know, share, they can go house hunting together, and they can share opening presents on Christmas together. And then that's the little moment of, you know, of the little exhale when they're not at each other's throats, where you can see that it's a loving relationship.
In a weird way. You know, I mean, the daughter is certainly put in a position to deal.
Yeah. Well, yes, the mother has a bit, she's a little bit passive aggressive. Just a little.
Yeah.
But it's coming from heart.
Yeah.
You know, well, it's coming from, like, she just wants to shake her by the shoulders and say, get your act together.
Right. And also, she knows what she knows.
Yeah.
Like, she, you know, like that character, I would assume that, you know, even is that, you know, you don't necessarily look at it and think it's good parenting.
Right.
But I would imagine that when you're looking at it and preparing, you have to really believe that she loves her daughter.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. But all these criticisms are for a reason.
Right.
It's not just because I woke up grumpy today.
Right.
And you make me sick.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
You know, it's to prepare. It's your job
to
prepare that kid to be able to fly off,
uh-huh.
you know. And so if you look at her and you don't feel she's prepared, it's like a slap in your own face.
Oh, see that's the trick of that character, I think. That like, you know, I don't want her to embarrass me.
Yeah.
And I don't want her to let me down.
Yes, but also I want her to succeed ultimately.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
But those are kind of some...
Though the character is really nice and complex, because she's also, she feels shame.
Yeah.
She didn't expect them to be financially in
right.
where they are.
Right.
You know, there's a shame in that, the wrong side of the tracks.
Yeah.
You know, how dare you call us that in front of people?
Right. And how do you put all that in place? Is there a technique to it, or you just do it? You know, is it like, do you keep reading it? How many times do you read it?
Keep reading it. I really relied on Greta.
Yeah.
Because she was the source.
Right.
You know, because she not only wrote it, but she directed it. So for any question I had, or for any, about something specific, or what's the backstory on this? Why am I saying this right now? Or all the way up to, what do you want the tone to be for this scene? Because it's another battle. How do we make it different?
Right.
You know, or who's triggering who? Can we deconstruct it down to that?
You'd have those conversations with Greta Gerwig.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, like, that's not always the case with film directors, though, is it? That you have that kind of interaction or that kind of communication about nuanced things.
Yeah. No, it's not always the case.
Sometimes you're just left to your own devices.
Yes. And some people just want to be, and, you know, that's fine.
Yeah.
Unless there is a problem.
Right.
Unless you need the help.
Right.
And then it's like the desperate, help me, help me, help me. So it's always great. Other, you know,
yeah.
Versus stay back there out of my eye line. I know right. how to do this.
Yeah, right.
it's a weird seesaw of both those things.
Well, but do you have that experience too when you work on television and in film? That yeah, just leave me be. I'm
looking for a director, looking towards.
Well, no, saying like I got this.
In TV, I have found that it's. It seems like TV directors think that it's impolite or something
yeah.
to give a note to a character that's been established and that actor has been doing that character for years.
Uh-huh.
So I think those directors, I would gladly take a note,
right.
especially a good note
yeah.
from any director at any time. But
right.
I feel that they have a trepidation about it, you know, that you know the character better than they ever could.
Yeah.
And so they should just not say anything at all.
Because a lot of times in TV, they're just there for a couple episodes, the directors.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And they're there also to, you know, just the technical side is just, you know, I only work in that multi-camera setting,
yeah.
but it's just to, you know, work with the camera, with the DP
right,
and the camera
right.
operators.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Get, nail down the technical side.
Sure. But like working with Greta and working with how do you pronounce her name?
Saoirse.
She was great.
Yeah, I know. Well, like one of my favorite scenes is the opening scene that we have in the car.
Yeah.
We had such fun doing that because it was basically one shot.
Yeah.
And we knew that Greta didn't care if we were overlapping each other, and it had a nice messy feel to it.
Uh-huh.
It had the spectrum of emotions in it.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're crying at the beginning and having a nice time ending up their college drive, and then somebody triggers somebody and it's off to the races
right.
like at 100 miles an hour until
right.
she throws herself out,
right.
out
oh,
of the moving car.
Right.
And
it,
which was horrifying,
horrifying
to look at because
yeah.
it looked way too real.
It did. In the, oh,
even
yeah.
from my viewpoint,
it's crazy.
You know, when I watched her do it.
Yeah. How did they do that?
They had like a platform built on the side of the car, and I wasn't really driving. It was
oh.
being pulled.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah.
That was a crazy opening.
Mm-hmm. I know. It set the tone for the whole movie, didn't it? It's just
yeah.
like, I think I know where this is going. Oh, no, I don't.
So when you work with another actor, even somebody as young as her, what are you looking for? Reciprocity? Are you looking to land? Like,
yeah. You're well, you know, she has way more film experience than I do.
Really?
And so yes, by far. And so I would look to her, you know, to like, are we on the same page here? Is this, you know, she is totally present.
Yeah.
She has done all of her homework, which you'd think should be a given.
Yeah.
If
yeah.
you're granted a part to play in something in
sure.
anything
yeah
but sometimes people don't always do it. They do it in the hair and makeup chair
right
that morning
right
you know
that, yeah sure
and so
on the first day of work they're
yes.
just sort of like where's
yeah.
the script, where are my sides,
yeah yeah yeah
yeah,
where are my sides, yeah,
yeah.
I should look at this now,
yeah right
so I'll hold up things while I sit in my trailer for a while.
Uh-huh.
You
yeah,
know
yeah.
I appreciate a really strong work ethic because that's how I like to work.
Uh-huh.
And so, and Saoirse is all about that also. But the other side of her, which is so wonderful, is as much as she cares about the work and is dependable, so reliable, dedicated, she also sets a wonderful tone with the cast and crew.
Mm-hmm.
She knows every single person's name.
Oh,
she checks in with everybody every
wow.
morning. As soon as she walks into the hair and makeup trailer, just everything lights up. She just
wow.
literally brings joy.
That's amazing.
To the set.
Yeah. I'm definitely not a like remember everyone's name guy.
Me either.
It's hard.
It's
but
really
I mean
hard.
I can't do it in my life. Do you
no.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I'm just I can't
I don't have any more brain capacity left to
right.
memorize,
right.
to use, what do you call those little memorizing tricks, you know,
yeah,
like
a device? A
mnemonic or something.
Oh, really?
Like
there's
that.
There's a trick to it?
To learn it and store it away in case I ever need to use it again.
Yeah.
There's no... not enough memory in there left.
Right. It does get a little depleted as you get older. I'm
yeah.
finding that.
Yeah.
It's a relief, though, sometimes.
It's funny.
It.
I have no problem learning a whole play.
Right. Right. I'm very good with lines, but like I can't remember something I did yesterday. Like, when did we do that?
Right.
Like, it's weird.
Right.
We were at that place, you know, 2 days ago.
Yes.
Well, you remember pages and pages of dialogue.
Yeah.
So how did you get the part on, like, because Roseanne is sort of the life-changing thing, right? In terms of career.
Right.
How did that happen for an actress from where you were at? Where were you? How did that go?
Well, I was in, sitting in Chicago, I think.
Oh, really?
And I had done one movie.
Yeah.
And I had only done the one movie because the casting director saw Balm and Gilead.
What movie?
It's all connected. Desperately Seeking Susan.
Oh, my God. So they, Madonna?
They hired me for that. That was the first movie I ever did. Yeah. And then, so those casting directors knew me.
Yeah.
And when the role of Roseanne's sister came up, this is the weirdest thing. Yeah. I had gone from Chicago just on a fluke. I had like 2 weeks between plays.
Yeah.
I'd gone to L.A.
Yeah.
To thinking, well, maybe I can get a movie.
Right.
And
sure.
So I was there for 2 weeks. I slept on somebody's couch. And it was during those 2 weeks that they were casting Roseanne. And I happened to be in town. And they brought me in. And they didn't have the sides written for the sister yet. So I just read Roseanne lines.
Uh-huh.
And I got the part off of that.
Wow.
In the first 2 weeks that I went there.
Yeah.
And I got a car. And I didn't have any... anybody to sign to vouch for me or anything. So Gary Sinise had to come over and, you know, co-sign for it. He was in LA.
Uh-huh. And so that was it. That was then the rest is history. You're
the
on
next
Roseanne.
9 years were.
Yeah.
9 seasons.
Crazy, right?
Yes.
You became a real family.
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the kids grew up on it and my kids grew up on it.
It's crazy. And you have one daughter who's an actress?
Mm-hmm.
And she's doing well.
Yeah. That's my daughter with Jeff Perry, Zoe Perry.
Yeah.
And she's on Young Sheldon. She's the mom on that.
Oh, it's...
And which is so bizarre because I'm his mom on Big Bang.
You,
so we're playing the same person decades apart on concurrently running shows.
They did that on purpose.
This can't have ever happened before.
No, but that was obviously intentional. It was...
Well, the...
It was good that your daughter knows how to act.
Created the spinoff,
yeah,
you know,
right,
without thinking about her.
Right.
But she was on the radar to be brought in to read for the part.
Sure, yeah. Sure. And she got it. That's hilarious. But and also you're doing the new Roseanne.
Yeah, we did it.
How many did you shoot?
9.
And then they're going to be on where?
On ABC.
Oh, you're going back home.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
We really went home. We went back to the same lot.
And they rebuilt the set?
Yes, they had to recraft it from scratch because it had been destroyed. I think they saved the couch. Uh-huh. I think I heard, maybe this is a rumor, that the couch is in like the Smithsonian.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, or the Afghan, something like that. But they had to, down to the wallpaper. They don't make the wallpaper anymore.
They didn't update the house at all?
There's a new fridge.
That's it?
Yeah, they're still there.
Huh.
Yeah. It was surreal walking onto that.
I can't imagine.
It had been 20 years since it ended, and it had been 29 years since the pilot.
Wow.
I know. That's freaky and horrifying at the same time.
Now, when you work, like, I imagine the character of Jackie over time, you know, you audition, you get the part, and, you know, doing three-camera shoots on a soundstage, it's almost like a vaudeville in a sense. It's like a play, but it's a little more controlled, and you stop and start, and the audience is part of it.
You do, and there is a live audience.
Yeah.
But that's, the live audience is about as play-like as it gets.
Right. Right. That's right, because you just stop and start, and there's no...
Yeah.
But that character, how did that, you know, you had to evolve that character in real time.
I'm not sure how I got cast, actually, but over time, the writers, who, like I said, I have so much respect for, that's where it all stems from, but they would notice, like, what my strengths were.
Yeah.
And then they would start writing for it.
Yeah, that's
and
great.
So they evolved it.
Right, right.
Without
right.
me even knowing.
But, you know, in real time, almost.
Yes.
Sure. So now I've heard that in this new bunch of shows, Roseanne shows, that Roseanne, who I've had in here as well, she's Roseanne. And, you know, she's great.
Mm-hmm.
She's a force of nature.
She is.
And I have a lot of respect for her. And we had a good time. She ate some cantaloupe. It was a good conversation. But in the show, She's a Trump supporter, mm-hmm. right? And the rest of the family is not?
I'm not.
Okay.
And the rest of the family I have no idea about. We don't get into that.
Oh, you don't?
No. But she and I have a conflict over we only deal with it in the first show.
Uh-huh.
Because the stories have remained really about the family.
Right.
And even though we're talking politics in the first show, it's still about the family. The
right.
rift that it's caused between the sisters,
right.
which has caused in other families.
Sure.
It goes even deeper than how they voted.
Right.
You know, so we go, it makes them go way down and see where their weird
from way back.
Power struggle
uh-huh.
has always been there.
So ultimately, you know,
so the voting like highlighted these
right.
other deeper problems that they have. So I think that's the kind of writing that Roseanne always had. You know, she could take sensitive issues or dramatic issues, and the show could handle the weight of
right.
those, whereas on other sitcoms, it would be too jarring if they were talking about, like, abuse.
Right, but it comes down to the family. It always comes down to those relationships.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how they've started this new small arc
uh-huh.
that we do.
And what is, and like, being with John and everybody, it must be so odd.
It is, and yet it's,
So
comfortable. Yeah. And it's really like no time has passed at all. Like, we took a hiatus week.
Yeah.
And we came right back to start season 10.
That's so wild.
Which is what it would have been. You know, it's so cool because the scenes that they've written now, you can play that you have a history with another character.
Yeah.
We really do. We're living it.
Right.
You know, I stood off stage, off camera, and watched the daughters have an argument together.
Yeah.
And just thinking, that goes back so far.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
To see them now in their 40s.
Wow.
And still sisters.
Yeah.
And in that same environment. And it's also cool to watch Darlene's character parenting her kids in right. that same kitchen.
Yeah.
With Roseanne standing off to the side, judging it.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
Because of their history.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating.
And did everyone get along?
Everybody. Yeah. Everybody had the time of their life. And if it's well received, which I hope it is, because everybody felt that responsibility.
Yeah.
Because people loved it so much
sure.
that you don't want to taint it in any way.
Yeah.
Everybody would come back and do it again.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was fun and...
That's so wild.
Creative.
Who's writing on it?
We had some of the old writers and some new writers.
Uh-huh.
So Bruce Helford.
Yeah.
Whitney Cummings.
Yeah.
That's the old and the new.
Yeah.
Wanda Sykes was on it. Norm Macdonald came back for some.
Wow.
The
whole crew.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing. And so Lady Bird, this whole journey with this thing as a film, you were at the Golden Globes.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to SAG Awards.
Yeah. Tonight I'm going to the LA Film Critics Association.
You won the Best Supporting Actress with them and New York, right?
Not New York.
Oh, God.
No, this one. So I'm going to that tonight, and then SAGs are in a week. And,
it's exciting, right?
Yeah. Oh, look, this is a whole new experience for me. I've never been on a train like this, ever.
Didn't you win for Roseanne? Emmy.
I won an Emmy.
Yeah.
I won some Emmys, but it was 100 years ago.
Sure.
You know, it wasn't the shit show that it is now.
Yeah. It's something, huh?
It is.
And
there's a strategy.
Oh, yeah.
And
you have people.
I didn't want people, but I got to sign some people.
Yeah. So it's very exciting, and I'm happy for you. But what do you want to do? Do you still love doing theater?
Yeah, I'm going back in a couple of weeks.
To do?
I'm going to do Three Tall Women by Edward Albee with, wait for it, Glenda Jackson.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
I can't wait to get in the room with her. Directed by Joe Mantello, who I adore.
He's been around a while, huh?
Yeah.
Where's it going to be, in New York?
At the Golden in New York. So we start rehearsing in like 2 weeks.
Glenda Jackson.
Yeah.
Wow. I haven't seen her in a long time.
Well, she's been in Parliament. for like 25 years.
Really?
Yeah. She won 2 Oscars, quit, served in Parliament for 25 years, and then came back to theater by not easing her way in, but jumped into playing King Lear. She was Lear.
Wow.
In a production.
How was that received?
Very well.
No kidding.
Yep.
That's insane. Yeah. Who was that woman? Like, I always forget her name. Lois
Smith?
Yeah. That was in Lady Bird.
She's wonderful.
So good.
She's fascinating. She makes it look so effortless, doesn't she?
Yeah. And she's done some amazing
stuff.
That
had a wonderful ensemble.
Yeah, it really did. It really did. You got movies coming up?
No.
Nothing? No one saying you want to do a movie?
Nope.
do you like doing movies? It's a little tedious, isn't it?
I can't say that I like doing them.
Mm-hmm.
It's only because of the way it's you have to approach them. I mean, from working either backwards or skipping around and
waiting coverage.
Yes, that's the truly a tedious part of it, and. I don't know. I'm just such a theater rat.
And so, what's the initial run for Three Tall Women?
4 months.
Oh well, good. Mm-hmm. So you're working. You're happy. This movie's great. You're on it. You know, you were great in it. And I'm just thrilled to talk to you. I know you got to get to a thing. You got a SAG screening now.
Uh huh.
That you got to go do a panel. You like doing the panels?
I can't say that I enjoy any of it.
Well, if anything came up here that would, you can use on the panel, just go ahead. You've already, you talked about it, because sometimes that happens when you talk for a while. You go like, oh, just bring that up.
But yeah.
You probably talked about Lady Bird a lot of these things. How many panels have you done?
Well, those SAG panels, it's nice, I guess, especially if you go to a screening and you get to see some of the actors come out afterwards and answer questions.
Yeah,
that's exciting.
It's exciting for the actors.
I mean, it would be for me, if I was
Have you done the SAG screenings before?
No,
I
don't do any movies.
No, but I mean, for this movie, have you already done a few SAG screenings?
A few, yes.
Because some of the same people come.
Oh, they do? They come back to see the movie again?
Yeah, they come back to see. I did some with Glow, and I swear to God, there's about 4 or 5 that have come to everyone from the SAG screenings just to get to see the panel afterwards? Yeah, just to hang out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting to see people in movies. I still like, when I was at the Critics' Choice and I was doing the line, they were asking me, do you like coming to these? I've never been to one. That was my first. I've never been to the Emmys or nothing. I've never been nominated for nothing. So that was it. And really just I like looking at movie stars.
I like seeing people that I really respect, and I'm not ever going to approach,
but
I just like seeing them, just to make sure that they're real.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Gary Oldman was at the next table, and I just every once in a while I'd be like, "It's right over there." It's that guy. He's just a person.
Yeah.
Yeah. You didn't meet anybody.
I've met people at all of them far.
People
yeah.
People come up to you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great to have something, that look, I feel like I'm the been eaten at the kid table for, up till now. And now I'm at the grown up table.
Oh,
and thankfully I have something to talk to them about because I was in a movie, that's getting
great.
I have a reason to be at the grown up table.
Well, congratulations on being at the grown up table.
Thank you.
Thanks for talking to me.
Thanks.
What a sweet genius. She's amazing. I love talking to Laurie Metcalf. I hope you like that as well. Again, Lady Bird's amazing. The revival of Roseanne will premiere on ABC in March. And just a real honor talking to her. Okay, I got a guitar here. All right. Boomer lives.